Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. This is a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and wellness. And that's really my passion, and that's why I do these programs, to be able to have conversations with people who have great knowledge, great wisdom, great experience to help us so we can truly navigate through life in a way that's safe and empowering and allowing us to live as fully as we can possibly live and be able to share this knowledge and wisdom with our family and with our friends and our greater community. So thanks for joining me for another great conversation. And by the way, if you would like to get the archive shows, you can just go to my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know. Like me there, and all of my podcasts are posted on my Facebook page, as well as other information, of course, that I like to share. So that way you will be able to get every single episode, not miss a beat. And I hope you'll be joining me and liking me over there, part of my growing community. So today, we have a really important conversation, and I'm just so looking forward to the opportunity to talk to my guest, Dr. Dean Waldman. We're going to be talking about the predicament that we find ourselves in with our children, with mandates for getting vaccinated, as they call it, and some of the real risks and things that we need to be aware of in order to protect our children and our future, which our children are our future. So just let me share a little bit about my guest. Dr. Dean Waldman is a medical doctor, also has an MBA, and is the author of Curing the Cancer in U.S. Healthcare and 11 other books, as well as more than 250 articles and monographs. After nearly 50 years as a pediatric cardiologist, educator, researcher, medical administrator, and public policy advisor, Dr. Dean is in a unique position to help readers break through and break free of the nightmare we call our healthcare system. Dr. Dean studied medicine and trained at Yale, Chicago Medical School, the Mayo Clinic, Northwestern, and Harvard, and earned his MBA from Anderson Graduate School. As a consultant for hospitals, public and private organizations, as well as governments, Dr. Dean combines systems analysis and other management tools with the principles of good medical practice to diagnose and effectively treat sick systems such as healthcare. Dr. Dean was chief of pediatric cardiology at the Children's Hospital of San Diego, the University of Chicago, and the University of New Mexico. He was also director of Center for Healthcare Policy at Texas Public Policy Foundation and a member of the board of directors of New Mexico Health Insurance Exchange. Dr. Dean is professor emeritus of pediatrics, pathology, and decision science. His proposals for states care and market-based medicine have the potential to revolutionize healthcare in the United States. So, wow, it's such an honor and such a pleasure to have Dr. Dean with us today. And I want to welcome Dr. Dean to What Women Must Know. So, Dr. Dean, thank you for being with us today.
It is my great pleasure to join you.
Well, you certainly have had quite a career, Dr. Dean. It's quite, you know, awe-inspiring, to be honest, to read your bio and the amazing things you have not only contributed to but have initiated. So, you know, it's just such an honor to have you on the show so we can have some important conversations today. You know, I your background as a pediatric cardiologist or just as a, you know, focusing with cardiology in general seems to be so relevant today with what's happening to our children, and I know that is of great concern to you as well. So I'd like us to focus our conversation there to begin with, and then we'll see where it goes. But I always like to ask my guests, I find it really fascinating to learn if people's own personal journeys that have taken them through life and to the places where they are now and to the awarenesses and the passions they have. So Dr. Dean, tell us a little bit about your journey and your passions that have led you to the place where you are now, which is really raising a voice for true healthcare, sanity in how we address the needs of our health care and so many other critical issues?
Well, my journey is actually rather interesting, and given the fact that I'm so old, a rather lengthy story, but it's probably worth a few minutes for your listeners. I come from a long medical family. By that I mean literally the last four generations of my family, everybody, cousins, uncles, fathers, grandfathers, etc., have all been doctors. We had a family gathering a couple of years ago, actually in Colorado, and there were, I think, 17 family members present, of which 15 had at least MD, if not MD, PhD, or MD, MBA at their names. It was the dinner conversations certainly would make other people sick. Anyway, so I didn't have much of a choice. I claim to be the only child raised on the island of Manhattan who asked for piano lessons and was turned down because my mother was afraid that I would go into music, which was really my early passion. But, you know, as the only male left after the Second World War, I didn't have much of a choice. I had to go into medicine. So I did. And to make another long, somewhat painful story short, I almost went into the wrong field, namely surgery, specifically because it turns out it was the wrong thing for me to do because I like conscious patients, and specifically conscious patients who are either babies or children. I'm very good with them and not so good with adults. So I ended up being a pediatric cardiologist, which was, frankly, a wonderful thing to do. When I started in medical school, which is, you know, getting on 50 years ago, it was the leading cause of death in the first month of life, and it might have been the leading cause of death in the first year of life for children. Now our survival rate for children with congenital heart disease is somewhere around 98% to 99%, and that's all the expansion of medical knowledge and medical technology in the last 50 years. So we now do things routinely that were literally impossible when I was in medical school, and that was an experience that I went through as a physician, and all I can do when I think about it is, frankly, smile. So that I've been very blessed in that way, being able to save these children and fix their hearts and close holes and open channels and do all sorts of things that are just plain wonderful on the inside of a small child so that baby can live a normal life. To continue the journey, however, I was actually pretty good at various things and became the chief of cardiology at the University of Chicago. And I found that the system didn't seem to focus on the patient first. It focused on, and it's not just the U of C, most major institutions focus on the budget, and then they get to the patient after they fix the budget rather than the other way around. And that bothered me enormously. And I figured, okay, well, I'm not doing a good job as a leader, so maybe I need some of these business skills. So I went to school, actually. I went back to school at the age of 55 and got my MBA, figuring that then I could be a really good leader and I could sort of redirect the university hospital toward the patient and service to the patient. And the patient comes first is a big sign on the door, but it wasn't the reality. Well, I failed. I could not move the system really at all. We still had a phone tree as the answering service instead of a human being. I mean, that was a big bugaboo of mine. Anyway, so I began to say, well, what the heck is wrong with the system? And I realized that what's called systems theory or systems thinking is the same thing as practicing good medicine on a patient. It's just that systems theory is practicing good medicine on a system. you don't just treat the symptoms of the system, you find out the root cause of what's wrong with the system, and you fix that, which led me to do a 2-3 year study of the healthcare system as though it were a patient. And that's where I finally figured out not only what is really wrong, but what to do to fix it. Because once you know what the root cause is, you deal with the root cause and then the patient gets well. And that was my long-winded story of what my journey is to write this book called The Cancer in U.S. Healthcare. And since we're talking in a minute about the immediate topic, which is COVID, it's part and parcel, unfortunately, with the same problem, which is that the system, in this case the political system, is focused on itself and its power rather than focused on the welfare of the people, and in this case the medical welfare of Americans or Australians or Britons or whoever you want to talk about. And that's what we really need to talk about now.
And I just want to say it must be so frustrating, to say the least, for you to see that in the hospital setting where patients are asking for treatments, for medications, and I'm talking about COVID patients, are asking to receive treatments that have been known to be safe for decades, like ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, and have even judges ruling that the hospitals need to give these drugs to these patients to help them survive, and they're refused, and many of them die as a result. That just must be beyond comprehensible for you.
It is. You use the right word. It is incomprehensible, and quite frankly, unconscionable as far as I'm concerned, because if you think about it for a second, the judges or the politicians mainly are practicing medicine without a license. Well, excuse me, the patient in front of me is my responsibility. It's not my state representative's responsibility. It's not the hospital's responsibility, and it sure as hell ain't Washington's responsibility. It's my judgment. The patient chose me, and I should be making the decisions, or at least making the advisory recommendation, and let the patient make the decision, which is really the right way to do it. And there shouldn't be a third party, whether you call it an insurance executive or you call it a politician or a state legislator. They shouldn't be making any decisions between me and a patient.
That's in that perfect world of how medicine should be practiced.
Well, excuse me, but I would argue that, yeah, in a perfect world, but if you go back to, we got to go back to my grandfather. If you go back to my grandfather's day, which is like the early 20th century, that's the way things were. There wasn't a third-party decision maker. There was a medical insurance. It was mainly for lost wages and for bills over a certain amount, but that's in those days the medical decision maker was the patient with the advice of the doctor, and there wasn't a third party being a decision maker. And there's a big difference between having insurance cover medical costs or an insurance company saying no, you can't have that surgery, or you have to have that operation done at that place even though your doctor wants it done at another place. So I don't think that's a – not only do I not think that that's sort of an imaginary perfect world, it is a perfect world we had in a day when we really couldn't do much, namely my grandfather's day, when we didn't have the technologies we do today. But we could have that again if we simply reconnected the patient with his or her own money and with his or her own doctor without a third party in between. And that's basically what that book talks about. And COVID is a great example, since we really need to talk about that. There is no good rationale for the president of our country to tell a patient Hey, I'm running out of patients. Get the vaccination or else you'll lose your job, or else you'll be canceled, or else you can't go into a restaurant or a stadium without a passport. These are all medical decisions that people should make, not outside entities.
Well, I have a quick question, but I don't want us to get sidetracked because we can have a long conversation about this, which I'm fascinated with. But I will ask, what has happened that has transformed our medical freedoms into dictates now? What do you think has contributed to this transformation that we are seeing before our very eyes in the last year and a half?
Well, it started out in the state of Texas as an insurance plan where the insurance company said it would take, for a fixed amount of money, it would take care of a patient. Now, I forget the hospital where this plan initially started, and then the whole country now works this way. The problem is they meant well. It would started actually with a teachers union in, I want to say, Dallas, but I'm not sure. But the key mistake was that under this plan where, well, for a fixed amount of money, we'll take care of all of your medical needs, except for the fact that that means that neither you nor the doctor is the decision maker for what your medical care will be. You give up that power when you give up the money flow control. And that's how it started. And I repeat, I think it was a well-meaning intent on the part of a group of doctors or maybe a hospital. But what turned out was a third party is now the decision maker for your medical care. And worse, and here's the real tragic part of it, or part of the tragic element, is that at the present time, the United States spent almost exactly $4 trillion on its healthcare system, of which almost $2 trillion produced no care. It went to bureaucratic, administrative, oversight, regulatory costs. And so we, as physicians and nurses, can't give care of worth $2 trillion because the bureaucrats are stealing it.
Yeah.
Are you shocked or not?
Yes. Well, I'm always shocked, you know, to realize how our health care, how the rights to have health care and to make our choices has been stolen from us.
Because we
see the health deteriorating of people.
Yes, and you know, when you start, I did some research. Oh God, it's more than 10 years ago. Entitled a big research project, the corporate culture of healthcare. And what I really wanted to understand, and I'm going to give you the answer in a second. What I really want to understand was why so many of us, doctors and nurses and therapists and people who deliver care, who take care of other people, why so many of us were unhappy, frustrated, and frankly leaving medicine, me included. Why was I so unhappy? And make a very long 2.5 year project, I don't know how many million dollars we spent on interviews and so forth of everybody in healthcare. When I say everybody, I mean all levels of healthcare, including bureaucrats and the cleaning staff and the maintenance crew. Why are nurses and doctors so unhappy? And it's really, in a sense, very simple. There are two elements in any work, whatever work you do. One is the work content, and the other is the work environment. And if you think about it, the work content, I love taking care of kids. yeah, it's hard and it's scary sometimes, and occasionally we lose a baby and, you know, I feel like I've done something wrong even when I haven't, because the child didn't make it. But the content is the thing that keeps us going. The environment is supposed to help us take care of the patients, but instead the environment, the system, penalizes us, harasses us, tells us what we can't do, tells us what drugs we can't give the patients, says, well, you're going to have to wait 6 months before you have that surgery. It's the system that gets in our way when we try and take care of the patient, and that's why nurses and doctors are so damn frustrated, and why the nursing and doctor shortage is getting worse on a monthly basis. And now people are just saying, okay, if you want me to get this experimental gene therapy, which is what vaccination for COVID really is, it's not a vaccination, it's gene therapy, quite literally. Matter of fact, on the website, that's what they call it. If you go to the Pfizer website, it's not called a vaccination, it's gene therapy. Anyway, and it's experimental. We don't have any long-term data on this. And so a lot of my colleagues are saying, no, I cost-benefit for me as a person, I don't think this is a good value, and I don't want to take the risk when I'm a healthy person and I'm not immunocompromised, and the risk to me, which I happen to know, is very, very low, so I don't want this medication, and now the government is forcing me to do it. That's makes us crazy. And it's why thousands of people are literally leaving healthcare.
Yeah, it's, you know, we've arrived at a place that I don't think you ever thought would ever exist.
Nope, you're right.
We're being mandated to, right? You know?
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, all those.
All those years
you put into your study, into your profession, to provide the best care, and you're literally prevented from doing that.
I can tell you that every doctor in this country will spend some time every day fighting with some insurance agent or company or executive or medical director to try and get his or her patient what the patient really needs, rather than what the insurance company says the patient's going to get. That's a true statement that you can poll. There are, what, almost a million doctors in the United States. I'll bet you 99% will say, oh, yeah, yesterday I had to fight to get the drug X for my patient because the pharmacy benefit manager wouldn't allow it, or I wanted my patient operated by Dr. So-and-so, who's got the best results, but the insurance company has a contract with a different doctor, and I tried to get my patient to the better surgeon, but I failed.
Well, let's talk about children, because I know this is a passion for you, and I think that
yeah.
We have so many questions right now. Parents are, you know, caught between a rock and a hard place, to be honest, around this gene therapy that is being mandated,
sure.
This
sure.
experimental gene therapy treatment that has unknown ingredients added to the children's dose being mandated on our children.
All right,
so
let's talk about that first. Start with something that is, let's just say, has been labeled as misinformation, and certainly I've been canceled a couple of times on some articles that I've tried to publish. But here's the data. The fact is, according to our statistics right now, 765,962 people in the United States died due to COVID, except for the minor problem that's baloney. And what do I mean by that? We know that they died with a positive COVID test. That is, they had the COVID antigen in their body, and therefore, in theory, they either had or recently finished a COVID infection. But that's not the reason they died. You can only know the reason they died if you do an autopsy, because otherwise these people, and most of whom have pre-existing conditions, they have chronic lung disease, they have diabetes, they have heart failure, kidney failure, and so forth. I mean, the data is very clear from the CDC. That's the vast majority of deaths in this country. So the question is, and we'll get to the children in 1 second. The question is, well, wait a minute. If 765,000 people died with COVID, how many of them died because of COVID? There's a big difference between those two statements. And when you do a look at the autopsy data, of which there is some, there is actually a study from Italy, and there is also some CDC data here. What you find is between 12% and 23% of the people who died, quote, because of COVID, actually didn't die because of COVID. They died with COVID. So instead of 765,000 deaths due to COVID, this country merely had, and when I say merely, certainly 150,000 deaths is a terrible number, but that's merely double the number of people who die from the flu. And again, these are people who have pre-existing conditions, who are 75, 85, 90 years old. And so my point is that we got to be really careful when we say, well, what's the risk of death due to COVID? And when you do the analysis, what you find is that the risk of death for the general population is around 0.07%, or I'll give you 0.1, depending on how you play with the numbers. So that's about the same as the seasonal flu. When you look at children, and here's where we get to, obviously, the thing that's important to you, me, and certainly every mother that's listening, here's again the data. As of a couple of days ago, 2 days ago, 765,000 deaths in the United States, of which 595 were in children. We don't know how many because the CDC hasn't told us. We don't know how many of them had chronic asthma or leukemia or juvenile rheumatoid arthritis or juvenile diabetes, because that would predispose them to death. But I'll give you that they all died from COVID, due to COVID. I don't know that's true, but just for our statistics, let's say that's true. That means that the risk of death for a child in this country from COVID is 0.08%, or turn it around the positive, the likelihood that a child will survive a COVID infection is 99.9%. So I ask you, are we going to give an experimental injection in the children of whom 99.9% of them don't need it? That was a rhetorical question. And obviously, I feel rather strongly, and you ought to feel strongly, whoever's listening, what the answer is, which is an emphatic no.
So not only is this not a life-threatening, serious pandemic in general, but it has been hyped up with fear porn to make people succumb to the propaganda. But now, because this narrative has been created that created the fear that parents now, so many uneducated, unaware parents are dealing with, and for whatever agenda the government has to push it, what do you think the agenda is? Why?
I think it's very simple. And if you want a good example of what I'm going to say, you've got to just watch Dr. Fauci on television. He revels in his notoriety and his people just wait for him to speak, and he pronounces, he doesn't, he tells us that the welfare of society is more important than my individual freedom, and yet he can't show me data that this virus is an existential risk, which is what they're presuming with their lockdowns and their mandates and their vaccine passports and so forth, when we know that the risk is just a little bit more or the same as the flu. And yet the answer to your question is they are power hungry. I'm sorry to be direct, but that is the fact. They want control. Washington, President Biden, his staff, and certainly Bernie Sanders and Fauci. I mean, Fauci hasn't practiced medicine in over 40 years, and so to call him a doctor is a little bit nauseating to those of us who actually take care of patients. That's their reason. Now, let's talk a little bit further, if it's okay with you, about the children. Two things that I really want people to hear. I want them to hear the data about masks, and I want them to hear the data about infection and death. When you look at the children and you say, by the way, we also need to talk for a second about the harm that is done by both the masks and the vaccination, which, of course, is not well discussed. Firstly, let me talk about masking our children, or what I call face masking our children from hockey. Here are a series of quotes from a good randomized controlled studies on mask protection in children. Quote, masking did not reduce the infection rate. Another study reported that face mask use in child athletes did not have a significant relationship to the incidence of COVID-19. Let's see, another one from Oxford in England did not find any correlation between illness and mask mandates. So, and also that was a study done in New York school system and Massachusetts school system, where I went to school. My point, the masks are a virtue signal, and they're not they're sort of a magic talisman, and they're not helpful in preventing illness, which, by the way, isn't a serious illness in the children anyway. Meanwhile, let's think about this for a second, which is you're talking about a child, and a child is in the, hopefully, education system. Everybody knows that you have impaired, I'll just be kind, impaired connection and communication when you can't see the face of the person talking, or you can't really hear them, what they're saying, you can't read their lips, and so this virtual learning with a teacher who's wearing a mask is like a joke. And so we are harming our children by the very masking of them, in addition to all the social isolation that occurs in the children. It was about 4 months ago. I read a paper. The incidence of teen suicide, primarily due to isolation and depression secondary to isolation, was up 340%. Nobody's talking about that. So this whole business with social distancing, with isolating our children, we won't even discuss isolating our elders, which is another terrible story. This is all harming our children, not helping them. Now, there's something else I want you to hear. Here's a study that was done in Florida. It makes me ill to even have to say this, but It was a study done by 11 parent group sets of parents who asked the question, which of course the CDC should have asked a year and a half ago, is there any danger, medical danger, to a face mask? So nobody seems to have asked that question until we got to these Florida parents. So the parents got their kids' masks and sent them to a lab and simply said, will you please look at what kinds of germs are in the masks? And lo and behold, when they did that, they found all sorts of much more dangerous pathogens inside the masks that the kids were breathing, the pathogens for Lyme disease, for meningitis, for tuberculosis, were in the masks that the kids were breathing. Now, is that true for 5%, 20%, 500%? I have no idea, because our medical institutions don't want to do safety studies of the responses that they're giving to this scam, or sham, I should say, pandemic. So between the social harm, the medical harm, and the lack of risk when we get to vaccination, it is very clear that we should not be putting a face mask on our children, that they should be going to school, that they should be allowed to interact with each other, and that I'm not saying that a parent shouldn't give a child a vaccine. I personally would advise not to do it, but the important thing to me is that the parent, and only the parent, should make that decision as to the best course and the welfare of their child. It shouldn't be my decision, your decision, the state's decision, God knows, not Biden's decision, or an insurance company's decision. That's a decision that should be made only by the parent. And I have three grandchildren, and God knows my children aren't vaccinating my grandchildren.
Yeah. I think that getting truthful information out there is so critical when it comes to the mask issues. And there's so many fights going on with school boards, so we can overturn these ridiculous, unscientific, medically negligent mandates.
Yep.
But let's continue this conversation and moving over to this mandating, as we talked about vaccines for the gene therapy for children. I want to ask you, as a pediatric cardiologist, what are you aware of, if not seeing directly, what are you aware of is happening to our children from this jab that's going on?
Well, I'm going to answer that question in about 30 seconds, but I have to tell you that I wrote an article which, believe it or not, nobody would publish, and the article simply analyzed it was a comparison of the immune efficiency, the immune effectiveness of the mRNA gene therapy, or the jab, as they call it. That thing actually started in Great Britain, the word jab, or versus natural immunity, namely that which is acquired by having had the COVID infection. And there are various studies, including one from Israel, as well as certainly epidemiologic data from this country. And the bottom line is that natural immunity is much more protective than mRNA gene therapy. Now, let me explain to your audience exactly the difference between the two of them, and it's really kind of simple. Firstly, a virus, any virus, has got a whole bunch of sites, S-I-T-E-S, on the virus, the outside part of the virus, that, for want of a better term, you can call them protein spikes. They're not actually, they don't look like spikes, but it's easier to envision that. So let's call them protein spikes. And an average of virus will have anywhere from maybe 20 to 30 or 40 of these spikes sticking out from the surface of the virus itself. mRNA therapy finds the pharmaceutical company did was they isolated a spike, and they said, okay, now we will develop a messenger RNA protein, which is what mRNA stands for, which will recognize that spike and will tell your immune system, both the antibodies and the T cells and the B cells, your whole immune system, oop, that's a bad guy. You better go get him right now. And so when the somebody gets mRNA injection and then gets protein, then gets COVID, the immune system sees that spike and goes, oh, okay, I got to attack that. Here's the problem. Number one, what if the virus mutates, as in the sequences after the Delta variant, and it might have not have that spike on it? And if it doesn't have that spike on it, then it won't, your immune system won't recognize it and won't go and attack it. Now, contrast that to natural immunity. Natural immunity, what happens is you get the COVID virus into your system, and your immune cells, mainly the T cells and B cells, recognize all of those spikes and say, wait a minute, all of these proteins, they're not natural to my body. They're wrong. They're an invader, and so we're going to go and attack them. And what happens is the human body first makes the antibodies, and then the T cells ramp up. And what's really important, why people need to know the difference between those cells and the antibodies, is the antibodies first come first, and they go and kill the virus. And when they've done killing the virus, the antibodies go away. So if you have an infection with COVID, the antibodies come and they kill the virus. And then if you look at that patient 6 months or 9 months later, you may find no antibodies. And so the narrative goes, the official narrative, oh, well, see, they're no longer protected, which is not true. The fact is the T cells and the B cells, and again, I've got scientific proof to support what I'm about to say, they are your long-term memory. They're the ones that say, oops, I recognize that virus, even if it comes back 6 months or a year later. And the T cells go, oops, that's a bad guy. And it's in my memory bank that those protein spikes are a bad invader, and we have to ramp up and kill them. So here's the point. When somebody says that something is 60% or 80% or 40% effective, and that the effectiveness goes away over time, they're talking about the antibodies, not the T cells. And the fact is, the only way to know if you have long-term protective effectiveness against the virus is to test a person's T cells. Now, that study has been done in, I want to say, 300 and some odd patients. It was some number of that magnitude who got COVID. And the bottom line is, I think it was 88 to 90% of them had T-cell memory a year after the infection. My point is that natural immunity not only is better and more efficient at killing the virus, because it'll recognize any one of those proteins and go after the virus, but it has long-term memory. And so that's why the mRNA jab, as you will, is less effective, and also we'll get to the risks associated with the so-called vaccine or the jab. There are more and more reports of clots in a person's body, in both arteries and veins, which is the arteries are clots in there are terrible. Nick Cordero is an actor that we happen to like, and he died. He was, I want to say, 44 of those clots. And then there's myocarditis. You know, I'm a pediatric cardiologist, and myocarditis is an inflammation of the heart muscle. And fortunately, it in children is often not fatal, but it can be fatal, and it sure as heck can damage the heart muscle. So it is a very bad infection to have, and apparently there is a significant incidence of myocarditis due to the jab. So, a very long-winded answer to where we started with the children, which is masking them is not protective and is potentially harmful. Vaccinating the children is certainly not worth the risk of myocarditis, of blood clots, and so forth. And the risk to the children of COVID is so low that almost any risk from the vaccination is makes you say, I don't want the child vaccinated, which is why my grandchildren aren't and won't be.
Yes, because it's an experiment on our children.
Well, you know, nobody's talking, you're of course right, nobody's talking about the fact that we have no, repeat, no, long-term data on mRNA therapy. You know, people say, well, you know, we get polio vaccines and we get MMR and we get diphtheria, smallpox, and so forth. Yeah, and we have anywhere from a minimum of 40 years to as much as 75 years of long-term data on the risks and the benefits long-term of these various vaccines that are that we give our children, which is the risk-benefit for polio or tetanus or diphtheria vaccination. The risks are low and the benefit is great, and so as parents, we rightly vaccinate our children. We don't have any of that data for mRNA, and I reiterate, I'm not going to give my grandchildren an experimental therapy when we don't even have any long-term data. Maybe you'll, I mean, I hate to bring this up, but let's talk for a minute about probably what was considered the safest sleeping medication given what are we talking about, 50 years ago. It's a drug called thalidomide. Do you know what I'm talking about, Cheryl?
I have a cousin who's a victim of thalidomide.
Okay, thalidomide was considered, well, the safest sleeping aid around is thalidomide, and for men, it is probably is. The safest sleeping aid you can get. And for non-pregnant women, it is also a safe medication. But we didn't have long-term data when it was released, and guess what? It had horrible effects on the fetus, of a developing child. And so we let it go. And as a result, we have a number of children, well, now adults, with no arms and legs.
Yeah. And you know, the concern for giving children this mandated jab or gene therapy is what we're seeing, like the what's showing up with the athletes, with the high school and college athletes, and there's this rash of athletes collapsing with heart attacks or myocarditis, and the news media goes, so strange, it's so strange. You know, it's like they can't figure it out. It's like blinding flash of the obvious, right?
Well, I reiterate, I mean, if you think about it, name another medicine that we would give anybody, much less the children, when we don't have long-term outcome data.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't care what you call it. I'm not going to give a child a medication that looks great in a Petri dish, but I don't know what the long-term effect, 5, 10, how about 40 years? I mean, we may turn around, and I hope what I'm going to say is wrong, because I hope that the children won't be harmed. But for all I know, 10 years from now or 20 years from now, we're going to somebody's going to report a study of 12% damage to the heart muscle in children, 12% of children who I'm making this up, but you'll see where I'm going. 12% of children have damaged heart muscles in the population that was given the mRNA vaccine. My God. You know, you got a 12% damage for a risk that was less than 0.1%. I mean, that's medical malpractice, that's unconscionable, that's immoral, that's any word you want to use, but it's, and so therefore, we don't, good doctors don't give experimental medications unless we have to, because we don't have a choice. So, yeah, we'll give an experimental medication to a child who's got a form of cancer for which we have no good options. Yeah, okay, we'll give that child. Or, I mean, I've done I don't know how many experimental procedures on children when there was no alternative. If I didn't try this, the child would die. Okay, fine.
And that was with informed consent.
That's right. As long as the parent understands, I'll actually tell you, if you have a minute, a really great story. This isn't COVID, but I had this patient who the baby was born to a woman, I won't say the name, who actually had been my resident in pediatrics. And so I trained her, and then she became an attending at my hospital, and she married an emergency room physician at our hospital, and things are great, and she gets pregnant. And she has this baby, and this baby has this, I wouldn't say terrible, but it is terrible, heart condition where the valve that lets the blood go from the right-sided chamber, the right ventricle, into the lungs, the valve is completely blocked, and the blood can't get into the lungs. And there was, in the days when we're talking about, a 50% mortality for heart surgery, but on the other hand, if we didn't operate, the child would simply die, and so we were taking that risk with children with her particular problem. I went to the I've been working on this for a while with an idea of how to open that valve actually without surgery, by doing it with a catheter, putting a catheter up where the valve is, and puncturing the valve and then balloon enlarging the valve, and so opening up that thing without surgery. But the risk of the procedure that I was talking about is totally unknown because nobody had ever done it before. So I went to the parents and I told them, look, I have this idea. I've tried it a couple of times to see if I could do it in animals. And yes, I can at least get it there, but I've never done this in a human, and so I can't tell you the risk. I think it's worth it, the try, because a 50% death risk with surgery is enormous. And so they discussed it, and they decided to do it. But then they said to me, "But we want to be we want to be in the control room watching you do this." And I said, "Oh, okay. So here's what your choices are. I can do the procedure and constantly looking over my shoulder at you, worrying about what you were thinking, or I can spend my time paying attention to your baby. Which would you like?" And so, okay, fine. So I didn't let him in the control room. Anyway, we did the procedure. It actually worked. The child is now, he's 15. He's a competitive soccer player, and he's never had anything done since then. What's the whole genesis of this, reason for this story, is that was an experimental procedure where I didn't have really a good alternative other than a 50% death risk with surgery. And so, yes, you do something experimental because the risk of the alternative is too terrible to contemplate. With COVID, it's exactly the opposite. The risk of the illness is exceedingly low. The risk of the jab is real but unknown at present. And so why would you ever, as a physician, recommend vaccinating a child with mRNA when the risk-benefit is a negative?
And that really wraps it up, and we've come to the end of the time we have, but that really says it all. And, Dr. Dean, I just really want to thank you for your courage and the commitment to speak the truth against all odds in many cases, that, you're such a source of light in this world. So I just want to personally thank you for the passion you have for helping and truly serving humanity. And if people want to know more about Dr. Dean, go to his website, deanwaldman.com, and he has lots of blogs and information, and he has a Facebook page, and I know you get some free bonus items if you go and visit the website, Dean, D-E-A-N-E, Dean with an E at the end, Waldman, W-A-L-D-M-A-N. Dr. Dean, thank you so much for your time, for your passion, for the wonderful wisdom and knowledge you've shared with us today. I'm so appreciative.
It was my pleasure to be with you.
I'm sure everyone listening is. It is such an honor to have you. So thank you again. Thank you all for listening. Join me every week on What Women Must Know. And until then, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.